Live from CAP Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. When we go online, a main goal is to get informed and connect with others. It's a tool often at our fingertips that has the capacity to benefit our lives. And it does. But there's also a lot of room for the information we take in and engage with to be harmful. As we all know, just because it's posted online doesn't make it true, but it can be hard to use that critical lens when emotions are high and issues are complicated. The fast pace of online and social media coverage creates room for error and also an opportunity to take advantage. The most recent largest display of misinformation and disinformation online can be found with the Israel-Hamas war. How we view the atrocities on innocent lives in Gaza and Israel can hinge greatly on where we're getting our information from. And with such an uncertain and quickly developing conflict, even trusted sources of news have publicly taken a hard look at their own coverage with the goal to improve. We're going to get a lesson in how to have productive conversations without confrontation and leave with some tools about what to trust, share, and act on. John Silva is with the News Literacy Project, an organization that works to dismantle misinformation tactics and trends, as well as connect people to the best practices to find credible sources. Welcome, John.
Good morning, Vicky. It's a pleasure to be here again.
It's nice to have you. I mean, you've joined us a couple times over the years. The first time you joined us was exactly 2 years ago. It was in October of 2021, and we talked broadly back then about misinformation. I mean, phrases that are now pretty common, vernacular, like fake news or alternative facts. And we were coming off of the 2020 election, the January 6th insurrection, of course, the pandemic. And I just think about all that has happened in the time since you first joined us. How has your work evolved in that time?
You're right. There seems to be a never-ending parade of topics where misinformation, unfortunately, becomes a major issue. As we have been doing our work for the last many years, we have been thinking about new and important strategies, not only for our primary work of working with educators to teach young people about credible sources of news and information, but we're working with what we're calling civic learning, trying to work with adults to understand just how difficult it can be to find and prioritize those credible sources.
Given that this organization, the News Literacy Project, I mean, it was founded back in 2008, you know, so that's more than a decade ago. I would imagine when you're talking about that civic engagement, that the awareness of misinformation and disinformation, it's evolved greatly since this nonprofit was founded 15 years ago.
Oh, it's evolved significantly. You know, when Alan Miller first founded this, it was really a smaller operation focused on teaching young people about quality journalism, focused on where to get your news and current events. And, you know, especially since about the 2016 election, this has taken on a much larger national urgency in many different ways.
Can you remind us of the difference between misinformation and disinformation?
Sure. So disinformation is anything that is intentionally and knowingly created to be false, with the intention of trying to make people believe that it's true, right? So if I make something up and I spread it online and I'm hoping people think it's real, that's disinformation. Once someone sees it, if they think it's real and they spread it, then it becomes misinformation. Misinformation is a much broader definition that way.
Going back to when this nonprofit was founded in 2008, I mean, the online digital landscape looked completely different than what it looks like now. Mm-hmm. I mean, we have social media apps now that evolved greatly just in the last couple of years to use these algorithms that cater to an individual user. But can you explain how this has shaped how or even if we have access to reliable sources and even different viewpoints?
I think with the incredible prevalence of social media, but just in general, information that's online, there are so many more authoring tools that people can easily learn how to use. So an individual can create their own website, their own podcast. You know, there's very little technical know-how sometimes that you would need to go in to be able to create and publish your own information. And social media allows us to be able to share those viewpoints with as wide an audience as we can reach. And that's, I think, one of the big difficulties is that we see social media as, you know, being in some ways responsible for the spread of misinformation, but while there are a lot of things that platforms could be doing better, there's also a lot that we as individuals can should be thinking about in terms of our own behaviors and how we use social media to interact with one another.
Do you get frustrated when you go on social media apps?
Yes, I do a lot actually. I try not to go on social media too much in my off hours because I do spend so much time on it during work. But I think one of the more frustrating things that happens is sometimes when I see people I know sharing false information, especially people that I know well. And I'm like, I want to say, like, you should know better. We've talked about this.
Yeah, I can relate and understand that. Yeah, and I think at the root of this, I mean, a big piece is, we're human. We have hearts. It's hard not to get swept up in emotions, especially when we're taking in terrible moments in history, from war to how nations respond to natural disasters, protest over human rights. I mean, there are too many to list. When you go on social media, how do you navigate these apps during these really tough and emotional moments?
The most important thing that I recommend to people is the importance of just slowing down. When we are deeply invested in a topic, a breaking news event, any of those things that you mentioned, when we are going on and we are trying to find out what's happening, we tend to approach it through this emotional connection. And when we are processing information emotionally, it is far easier for misleading and false information to manipulate us into believing that it's true. So especially during breaking news situations, especially thing issues where lots of people are talking about it, that's when we need to pause and wait and try to think, okay, where can I get credible information instead of where can I get any information? That's an important distinction to make when you're trying to find out what's going on.
Yeah. And I think the most recent example is, what's happening in Israel and Gaza, with Hamas conducting coordinated attacks and kidnappings on Israel. It hasn't even been 3 weeks. But then with the response of Israeli airstrikes on Gaza, more than 5,300 people in Gaza have been killed and some 1,400 in Israel. And that's according to the United Nations. And in that time, in less than 3 weeks, we're inundated with an abyss of images and information online. And that can make it really difficult to sift through fact and fiction. What stands out to you about the information you're seeing online?
I think when we're talking about the conflict in Israel currently, we have an incredibly complex web of sort of different groups of people with different perspectives, all trying to push their particular viewpoint of what's happening. We have people, you have cultural connections, family connections, there's political issues, there's religious issues. And so you have people on both sides of the conflict, to oversimplify, both sides of the conflict, who are trying to push their own interpretation of things, their own views about the war. But also in that, you have this array of social media trolls, people who are just trying to make things worse simply because they can. And so people are creating all manner of misinformation and disinformation, using old video clips, even footage from like video games to AI generated imagery to just make this even more difficult to navigate because it is there are so many sources, so many people are trying to manipulate this to push the narrative to further their own views on these goals. And in that, what we're also struggling with is there aren't enough journalists on the ground who are able to report on this to tell us, from a journalistic perspective, things that have been verified and credible information. And so it is so overwhelmingly complicated. It even kind of breaks my brain a little bit.
Yeah, and the pace is just so fast, and especially when it's online or on social media, because there's even been instances of, reputable sources taking a hard look at their own coverage. Yesterday, the New York Times posted a long editorial note upon reflection that they would have taken more precautions with its early coverage of an explosion at a hospital in Gaza. A CNN reporter, I believe last week, issued an online apology about their reporting live on the ground in the heat of the moment, taking a hard look with hindsight. So there's also these unintentional missteps from what have historically have been trusted media sources. That just makes it even more complicated.
It is, but I think there's a very important thing we all have to remember with the, I think the New York Times is a great example of that. News organizations, journalists, they get it wrong sometimes, despite all their best efforts, despite all the checks and balances. You know, they're trying to get it right, but sometimes things go wrong. And when a news organization issues a correction, or especially an editor's note, like the New York Times did, that's actually a sign of credibility that we try to teach people, right? Standards-based ethical news organizations will own their mistakes. They will hold themselves accountable, and they will tell people, look, we made a mistake. Here's how it happened, and here's what we know now. And here's what we're going to do going forward to try to make sure that doesn't happen again. So it's important to remember that mistakes happen, and the credible sources own it and acknowledge it.
Given that you also joined us a year and a half ago in February of 2022 to talk about misinformation during the initial Russian invasion of Ukraine, a war that continues today, do you see any parallels or even key differences?
I think there's a lot of parallels between the two events. You know, we could put up a long list of comparisons where similar misinformation tactics, similar style of propaganda coming out of different sources. And that's one of the things I think we need to kind of remember, is that the skills that we try to talk about with news literacy, it's not unique to any one world event, national event, politics, what have you. The skills are really about understanding the information that's coming at you. How do we slow down? How do we evaluate sources? How do we determine if a news source is credible? And how can we check things for ourselves before we share it online?
In the 15 years that this organization has been around, I mean, you've seen it evolve. What gives you faith that news literacy education will prevail when the information landscape is already complex and it's going to likely continue? I mean, I think about AI.
AI there's a lot of scary things about AI when we talk about misinformation. But I think what gets me at my desk every morning continuing this work is the fact that more and more educators are showing interest in integrating news literacy into their curriculum. Whether it's using our resources or using from other organizations, more and more educators are taking interest in making this a priority. And we've also seen a number of states who are starting to implement these types of things into their state standards. New Jersey is a recent example that they call it information literacy. So it's a requirement. And here where I live in Illinois, media literacy and news literacy is built into both middle and high school state standards. And a number of states are looking at that as well. So more people are realizing just how important this is, and not just educators, but states' departments of education are seeing it as well.
You know, what I'm learning from you, because you have a wealth of information and tools online for educators, also just for the general public. And we have a link to that on our Insight page. But I think one of the biggest piece of the biggest tool we can take with us is just pausing before we have a knee-jerk reaction to what we see online.
It's so important. If we could just slow down and not let confirmation bias manipulate us into believing something, then we can slow down the emotional response and then maybe proceed with a more careful, critical response.
The comment section also can be harmful. You know, people can easily, you know, make a comment or respond to a comment on a post. I mean, so let's just say we have the capacity in that moment to take a breath and pause. What should we consider? What should we weigh when it comes to whether we should even comment or post in the first place?
Well, I think if we see someone has posted something false online, I think the most important thing first is how important is it to me to correct this person in particular, right? You know, there are people posting all over the place. And so I often caution people, don't get into fights with strangers on the internet. But if you're going to engage, we have an acronym that we call PEP. It stands for patience, empathy, and persistence. And the idea is that before you decide you're going to engage and talk, you're trying to talk to somebody about false information, you need to first recognize that they probably genuinely believe this is true. And so you have to approach this carefully in a way that's, I want to talk to you about this. I want to share information. I don't want to be confrontational. right? I don't want to call you names, and I want to present things in a way that where you can look at the information. Maybe we can talk about it together, and then keep at it, right? Keep at it and keep sharing things in a way that is calm and patient and non-confrontational. And usually, if you can do that, the person hopefully will be open to seeing what you have. And you might not get the best response out of them, but that's the best thing to remember. And I just want to say, this time last year, we were also talking about the upcoming holidays, right? There's going to be a lot of this is going to be a hot topic around a lot of tables in the next couple of months.
Yeah,
It's not, it's also
because what we take in online doesn't just exist online, it can
correct.
transfer to our relationships in real
Yeah.
life.
And so I think if we're talking about a group of people around the dinner table, it's also important to remember, do I do this in front of the whole family, or do I maybe take this person aside later and say, hey, can we talk about this a little bit? But again, don't be confrontational and be patient, because it may not happen right away.
John, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure.
John Silva is with the News Literacy Project, a nonpartisan nonprofit that works to dismantle misinformation tactics and trends, as well as the best practices to find credible sources. Up next, it's that time of year where a good amount of high school students are thinking about college, but data shows that less than half of Sacramento County students have completed the requirements to attend a UC or a Cal State. We'll learn more about why, as well as the programs working to help teens attain their higher education goals. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. It's that time of year when high school students are planning for the next stage of their lives. That can mean entering the workforce, joining the military, or for many students, attending a college or university. However, recent data shows that in Sacramento County, many students don't meet the requirements to attend a Cal State or UC out of high school. In six of the county's largest school districts, less than half of the student body has completed the required coursework to apply for California's four-year public universities. That success gap is especially widening for Native American and Black students. For some, the requirements to get into a Cal State or UC can seem arbitrary, while others face different barriers on their path to higher education. So, what can be done to help these students get ready for their next step? Cap Radio's Sacramento education reporter, Srishti Prabha, joins us now to shed more light on the issues surrounding these requirements and how college intervention programs and other groups are rising to the occasion. Good morning, Srishti.
Good morning, Vicki.
So your focus is on K-12 education in Sacramento schools, and this is in partnership with the Sacramento Observer. With a focus on students of color, when did you start honing in on college readiness?
I was noticing college fairs running throughout the county because college is a thing that now they have to start applying for. This is the season. And I got curious as to how many students were actually wanting to go to college. Luckily, data is quite easy to get in the state of California, and I noticed that the rates of students being ready for public university out of high school was low for all students in the county, not even just in the six major districts, in all the districts. And it has been for almost a decade. Then, with the help of our new Cap Radio reporter, Tony Rodriguez, I was able to distill some of the potential barriers. And I found having Tony, who is a Sacramento native and a Sac State graduate, support me through the story was extremely significant, since his life story paralleled a lot of the narratives we were hearing while we were reporting.
That's great. Before we dive into this data, because we do a deep dive, can you first just explain what college readiness is for a Cal State or a UC? Are the requirements essentially like the same as graduating from high school?
That's a great question, and they're actually not the same. And I really want to make that very clear. The requirements are not the same. You can graduate from high school without completing these UCCSU requirements or the A through G classes. So A through G classes, which are required to qualify for California's public universities, students have to complete a minimum of the graduation requirements plus all the classes with C's or better. And that involves taking 2 years of history, 4 years of English, 3 years of math, 2 to 3 years of science, 2 years of foreign language, 1 year of visual and performing arts, and a college preparatory elective. Educators argue the pros and cons of the requirements to graduate from high school not matching the A through G classes for CSUs and UCs. Michael Lynch is the co-founder of a college intervention program for boys of color called Improve Your Tomorrow, or IYT. His organization is embedded into some of the schools in the county, and he provides an alternate solution.
What I think that a system that works is when a student is placed on A through G as a default curriculum. That's what they did in Sac City a couple of years ago. I think what you saw was rises in achievements where all students are placed on, like in ninth and 10th grade, they're placed on the A through G pathway. And then they themselves and their family can make a decision in their junior year on whether or not like college is for themselves. And for IYT, and in particular, the 1300 campaign that we're running, that is a policy that we're trying to get all districts to adopt.
So Sac City Unified is the only district in the county that places students on the UC-CSU pathway automatically. But if you look at the data in Sac City Unified, it reflects that Black and Hispanic students are doing better, but the average is the same as the rest of the county. So then the questions are, what is working and what isn't? And to me, it seems like there are a few key things. There's issues with accessibility. There's barriers to higher education. The overall education system is not built for the general population.
Yeah, and even outside of Sac City, I mean, your reporting looks across Sacramento County, and it found that less than half, 46% of students are prepared for California's four-year public universities, and that percentage isn't equally distributed. You have a graph in your digital piece, and it's very visual, and it helped me visualize this pretty big gap between, you know, on the high end, students who identify as Asian and Filipino, which is like 71% and 67%, and then compared to Native American and Black students at the bottom at just 20% and 33% for meeting CSU and UC requirements. How did you come to better understand this data?
So I looked at the six largest districts, which are the most diverse districts, and I started to look at the data in between, like the cross-section of it all. It made it clear that Black, Hispanic, and Indigenous students are meeting those UCCSU requirements at lower rates than their white and Asian counterparts. So let's go through one district's piece of data. So San Juan Unified's college readiness rates are some of the lowest in Sacramento. The district reports that only 29% of Hispanic, 17% of Black, and 10% of Indigenous students are completing the A through G curriculum mandates to apply for a four-year public university in California. Comparatively, 37% of white and 47% of Asian students meet the same criteria. Overall, the data is still disheartening in a state where public universities are cheaper and that where data proves that financial outcomes are better for CSU graduates. A Georgetown study found that your income can increase by 75% with a bachelor's degree, but a college choice is crucial. And CSUs are reported to further improve future financial stability. And so naturally, it would be remiss of the California public school systems to not prep their students for these applications to CSUs and UCs.
So given that, you know, this is an issue that is facing many school districts, you know, how have districts in Sacramento County responded to the findings and the statistics?
So they are engaging with local organizations, some that are embedded into the school day, like Improve Your Tomorrow and Advanced Via Individual Determination, or AVID. There are some that are after school, like UCAN or United College Action Network, which is exploring the critical role of alternative pathways. And then Improve Your Tomorrow and UCAN both explore representative support, which is super important. That said, the data has remained relatively unchanged since 2016. Kristen Schnepp, the San Juan Unified's district assistant superintendent of San Juan Unified, said she is aware of the overall low college going rates and the inequitable practices at their school.
With all students, but especially students of color who might not have had success in some of the more challenging classes. And a lot of it's because of adult mindsets, lack of equitable grading practices. And so I think with all students, it's about building relationships and then having trust that I am not going to set you up for failure.
Srishti, given that you mentioned that the data has remained unchanged since 2016, I mean, a key period during this time was COVID and remote learning. What impact did that have on college readiness and also a student's aspirations to even going to a four-year school?
Yeah, it's actually interesting. If you look at the graph in our story, it actually doesn't show a great increase or decrease in the rates of college-going students overall. But one student that kind of spoke to this experience, I met him through the process of reporting. He is a Florin High School senior, and his name is Damaris Lewis Jr. Since he was 12 years old, he dreamed of attending UCLA, but things changed when COVID-19 hit.
After the pandemic, I was really struggling with my mental health. And because of that, I felt kind of hopeless because, you know, I wasn't doing good academically. I couldn't follow those dreams.
And Lewis points out the gaps in the school system when thinking about higher education and academics and why he sought the support of the college intervention program, Improve Your Tomorrow.
Growing up, I never noticed a lot of attention for people that look like me. So as an African-American, to walk into this space with other African-American brothers, it was really welcoming and it felt like I belonged in academics.
Yeah, what I'm learning from Damaris, and I think I can just even go back to high school myself, feeling supported is crucial, especially if you're among the first in your family to go to college. You know, it can be really hard to figure out on your own as a student, as a teenager. When you're talking to students, did you get a sense that maybe they feel discouraged about going to a four-year university given the challenges to meeting eligibility requirements?
So young people want a dream, and disillusionment is a byproduct of how they're treated by the adults in the system. And so I have one narrative of a student who fought all odds to become the first in his family to graduate from college. His name is Johan Cardenas. He's a former Improve Your Tomorrow graduate. He migrated from Mexico to South Sacramento when he was 15 years old. He was new to Valley High School and to the Elk Grove Unified School System. He was an English language learner. He was a student with only one parent for support. And the odds kind of feel like they were stacked against him.
And I remember asking, you know, how do I go to college? I want to go to college, to the person who was my counselor. They basically say you won't be able to go to college because you are way behind, right? You have to do A2Gs and you have to do all this. It really made me feel like I wasn't going to be able to accomplish that. IYT said something else. They said, you know, we see you in college. We think you have the what it takes. If you feel unprepared, you know, we will make sure to give you those tools.
And he is now a Sac State graduate working in policy. So yeah. Improve Your Tomorrow or IYT does work.
Yeah, that is awesome. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. We've been talking with Srishti Prabha, CAP Radio's Sacramento education reporter, about college readiness rates at six major Sacramento County school districts. So we're diving into why less than half of Sacramento County students meet the requirements to attend a Cal State or a UC. And we've been hearing the perspectives of students, school staff, organizations working to improve these numbers. But are there other barriers that we're missing when it comes to students seeking higher education?
I think the student narratives we've heard from Damaris and Johan kind of hinted at some of these things, right? Lack of diverse representation in school settings, incomplete knowledge or delayed understanding of A through G or the UC-CSU requirements. So let's talk a little bit about that. Michael Lynch, who runs IYT or Improve Your Tomorrow, feels that the A through G requirements can seem arbitrary and are not indicators of a student's ability to succeed in college.
Well, like, I understand the framework of like needing a benchmark of grades, like, in order to be able to show that you are eligible to attend a four-year public university. What I don't understand and continue to be confused at is why certain classes are required. Let me give an example. A lot of our students at IYT don't become eligible to attend a university because of Spanish 2, and they finish Spanish 2 like with a D. The second component too is the 3 years of math. Yeah, I get it, right? Math is important. It's an important component of like a GE education, but why 3 years? Why not 4 years? Why not 2 years? Like what is the metric of success that said that you have to take 3 years of math in order for you to be successful and graduate from Sacramento State with a degree in journalism?
And I thought that was a very valid question, one that we asked Sacramento State's Executive Director of Admission Outreach, Brian Henley. He believes foreign language courses can be an indicator of cultural fluency and inclusivity. However, if you think about a student like Johan, whose second language is his second language is actually English and his first language is Spanish, English can prove to be the barrier. And for Black students, I mean, it can be the one thing that keeps them from pursuing higher education or getting into a college. And both are students of color who maybe don't require cultural fluency in the same ways. So my personal conclusion is that they are arbitrary.
I want to go back to the beginning of our conversation when you shared a clip from the assistant superintendent at San Juan Unified, and she highlighted that there's this adult mindset which plays a role into whether a student is set up to meet the requirements to be college ready, especially with these more difficult classes. Can you elaborate what they meant by adult mindset?
Yeah, as we hear the narratives of students in these settings, it becomes quite apparent that some of the key underlying issues are based on perceptions. For example, taking a closer look at the AVID program, a college preparatory elective class students can choose to sign up for. It has 250 seniors out of 2,800 in San Juan Unified, which is a small subsect of seniors that are enrolled in their program. But they do have a 97% college-going rate, which is much higher than the average in the district. But AVID is only targeting those in the middle to high-performing academic group, even though they are minority students. So that requires an inherent interest and general knowledge on how to navigate higher education. Tracy Locke, who's the manager of the AVID program in San Juan Unified, explained that the AVID curriculum is rigorous. Here is what she had to say about students who are not interested in AVID.
Residually from talking to counselors and talking to students, they don't want to try. They don't see the value. It's more of a what's the point type of attitude. I would say more than that, it's the lack of desire.
These types of sentiments can be discouraging for students like Damaris and Johan, who haven't seen representation in academics and have parents who work multiple jobs to sustain their family's needs.
Yeah, I mean, I think any student, especially students with backgrounds like that, you know, they want to feel that confidence that people believe in them and not to feel like discouraged or demoralized about the process. So can these barriers persist beyond high schools? And what do districts do in-house to help boost college readiness and do so for all students equitably?
Right. So what happens in high schools can have prolonged effects beyond high school. We spoke with the executive director of Education Equity Solutions, Mina Dadgar, whose research outlines that the consequences of relegating students to remedial math in a community college classroom setting when they don't complete their A through G requirements can impact and create barriers for student success once they enter community college in California.
You know, gateway math, it used to be called gatekeeper math. The first college level math course is a gateway to whether students can succeed in college. The pass rates are generally, they hover nationally around 50%, much lower for Black and Brown Indigenous students. And really the question is, how can we stop students being filtered out of opportunity, given that, you know, some studies have found that the gateway math course is the number one barrier to earning an associate degree to transferring.
So through her research, she proposed solutions that would be potentially could be used in high school classrooms as well.
Evidence-based narrative is that there's a lot to do once students get into the classroom. So instead of assessing, sorting, and placing students into remediation, we should be focusing on resourcing faculty. And I can say more about what I mean by that. So should we change the name from office hours to student hours? Do we want to change the template of our syllabi? You know, that some of these things are very practical, that if, you know, something really difficult happens in your life, you can ask for an extension, because a first generation college student may not know that, whereas other students might, right?
So her research points to fostering belonging in math classes, providing embedded support within the classroom, and offering equitable accommodations for Black and brown students.
Yeah, because the classroom can also be intimidating.
Absolutely,
you know, especially
yeah.
Especially in higher education. Yeah. So we learned about, you know, Improve Your Tomorrow. That's just one college intervention program. And you mentioned others. You know, what others are out there and what has the response really been to these readiness programs?
So we also looked into United College Action Network, or UCAN, which is an organization focused on Sacramento students of color at an academic disadvantage and connects them to historically Black colleges and universities. And one of the narratives that we were hearing from the people working in these programs was that while on-site college counselors are accessible, many of times they have a caseload of up to several hundred students, which can be unrealistic and unmanageable. So peer mentorship, directed support, and cultural inclusivity, which is provided by UCAN and IYT, can be super significant. And Damaris, the student from the beginning of this segment who wanted to go to UCLA, is now planning to attend CSU Long Beach and possibly be the first in his immediate family to graduate from college. And all of this happened with the guidance of the mentors of IYT.
Honestly, it makes me feel kind of unstoppable. It makes me feel like I really can achieve anything that I want in life.
That's amazing. Are there any signs of these programs being expanded or their work being adopted or co-opted by schools to help students?
Yeah, they need to be more integrated into the school's work, but the districts do seem receptive to the work being provided by these organizations. Keep in mind, the organizations are not affiliated with the district, so they are usually 501c3s being funded through different modes than what you would have in an actual class that is embedded into the school system. However, the data still hasn't changed, and I think Dadgar is voicing concerns about actual practices within the education structure that need to change, and that structure has felt really impenetrable. So resourcing and educating staff requires a lot of funds, and whether or not we have those funds is the question.
Srishti, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me, Vicky.
Srishti Prabha is Cap Radio's Sacramento education reporter. Still ahead, Sacramento Poetry Day is where some of the most powerful voices of all ages compete and celebrate with original work. We'll learn more about the free event, which in turn fuels locally sourced poetry curriculum for hundreds of thousands of students. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.
Welcome back to Insight on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. There seems like there's a day for everything. National Taco Day, Bosses Day, Coffee Day, on and on and on. Cat Day, pick something. There's probably a day for it. But this Thursday in Sacramento, it's Poetry Day, and it's not some random day. Sacramento Poetry Day comes with a lot of meaning, action, and opportunity, touching 250,000 students in the Sacramento area, including two exciting contests for poetry enthusiasts of all ages to enter, and it's happening this week. Joining us to talk about Sacramento Poetry Day is the Sacramento Poet Laureate, Andrew Defy, and David and Yes Lorette DeMola, an award-winning, nationally ranked slam poet. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Hello.
So, Andrew, we started with you first last year. David, you're new to this. Let's start with you. I'd love to learn more about your background and how you jumped into the Sacramento poetry scene.
Oh, gosh. I jumped in at about 2011, and I
ended up joining the Sacramento Slam team. We did the National Poetry Slam, the individual World Poetry Slam. I'm currently on the board for the Sacramento Poetry Center, which is in the middle of a beautiful rejuvenation and a realignment of its values. And also, I formed a group called All City Writers, where we're taking poets who are professionally known in the scene and abroad, and we're making one-person shows out of their work.
What does poetry add to your life?
Since I was 11 years old, I've had major depression, and it's been a huge part of what's kept me alive through that condition. I used to be suicidal at one point, for a long stretch, and it's been a huge part of my healing process to find who I am.
Hmm. Yeah. How did you two connect with each other?
I was out at an open mic. I saw this person doing their thing up on the mic and was like, we must be friends. We must be friends. And then I think Dave came out to one of the Gorilla Flash Mobs, mm-hmm. and started singing with us at Tank House about Dirty Tots. Yeah. The rest is history.
Dirty Tots. Hey! Yeah.
That's awesome. I mean, what I'm learning from this, and it just sounds so great, is usually when we meet someone, it's like, hi, I'm Vicky. What's your name? And then you talk. But you two got introduced with each other. I think this is just one example, by actually hearing each other's poetry.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. And you get to, it's foregoing any of the casual conversation or small talk.
Just
and
jump right into being intimate.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
exactly.
Very much Pokemon rules. If you make eye contact with another poet, you have to face off against each other.
I love that. Okay, Andrew, so you're Sacramento's Poet Laureate. It's from 2020 to 2025. For someone who isn't familiar with this, talk to us about what this honor is.
As I tell the young people that I work with, it means I can spit poems with more marshmallows in my mouth than any poet in the city.
I'm challenging him for that.
Actually, what it means is I am the city's official poet. It does not mean I'm the best poet in the city. I got a better poet than me sitting right next to me. But what it means is no one in this city goes harder for poetry. No one advocates more. And that's what I see this job as being, is the biggest advocate for poetry and poets in the city.
So that brings me to Sacramento Poetry Day. It has a history. So tell us about that history and how it's evolved over the years.
Yeah, it was declared in 1986 after a group from the Sacramento Poetry Center wrote a book and published it called Landing Signals. Mm-hmm. It kind of got forgotten about for many years. And then in 2021, I got copied on an email that said, "What are we doing for Sacramento Poetry Day?" And I said, "Excuse me? There's a Sacramento Poetry Day? What are we doing?" And then last year, I got a fellowship with the American Academy of Poets. And part of that was to bring Sacramento Poetry Day back to life. So we created this curriculum, did a contest, had poets in schools, all kinds of things. And then we did the first awards gala last year, which is one of my favorite parts of the event.
I want to get to that curriculum part. It's so cool. Explain what happens in Sacramento schools. I mean, it touches like 250,000 students.
Yeah, absolutely. It's free and available for anyone that wants it at sacramentopoetryday.com. The curriculum was created alongside educators, so it reaches core education standards for K through 12, and also deals with, you know, some of the bigger feelings and the things that the ways that I see poetry being the most helpful for the young generation, handling and addressing things like mental health, like systemic oppression, like how do you find joy in your life, right? So, you know, it handles all of that social emotional, as well as learning literary devices and some of the more traditional language things.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a poet, but I do write. And I do feel like writing, whether it's stream of consciousness, it helps me understand myself better and it helps me process what I'm going through. And I think that's invaluable if you're a student.
You know, can I just say one thing to that, though? Because I hear that a lot, like me and him going to a lot of schools, and I meet a lot of kids and a lot of adults who say, like, I write poetry, but I'm not a poet. And it's, we put these weird gates on ourselves. You know what I mean? You are a poet. You write poetry, right?
Yeah, I write poetry.
You're a poet. Congratulations.
It feels uncomfortable,
you did it.
But sure. I just got to say it over and over again while looking in the mirror. But it is true, because we put these barriers up for ourselves. And I think there's enough barriers in the world, right?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And
especially,
you know,
as a poet.
Poetry isn't just getting up and reciting something that rhymes or a certain format, like you speak every day into that microphone and there's a flow to it and there's intentionality to it. Like you are a poem, Vicky.
Thank you so much. Well, David, you know, I want to go back to like when you were 11 to now and specifically in Sacramento, how has today's poetry, like how has it changed and evolved over the years?
You know, I was thinking about this because Andrew asked me that question yesterday, and I was thinking about it. And so to give a more full view of my life, I was born in Detroit, moved to South Sac, moved to New Hampshire, moved back here. From my view, poetry has different methods nowadays, but it's the same heart. Mm-hmm. Like the Sacramento Poetry Center was founded the same way that a lot of poetry groups are founded, which is a bunch of poets getting together and going like, hey, we should just work together and do something, make something of it.
Yeah.
And that's very much the same heart of what we have going today. I think the methods have changed a little bit. For me, for example, with All City Writers, I'm focused on trying to build up solo performances so that people can grow their art and actually present it outside of, you know, coffee shops and open mics and such.
That's awesome. Andrew, that brings me to Thursday. I mean, tell us, what do people need to know about Sacramento Poetry Day?
Well, the first thing is obviously the curriculum. We talked about that. So if you are an educator, you work with young people, I also just want to say this curriculum fits all year around. It also fits if you're outside of Sacramento. We've got people from up north. We've got people from Stockton that are talking about teaching this curriculum. In addition, we would love to have your applications for the contest, SacramentoPoetryDay.com. You can win $200 whether you are a student or an adult, and eggs are expensive, y'all. So make sure that you enter the contest. And then we've got the gala going on that night, the gala awards. And I just want to give a special shout out to the Sacramento Public Library and the way that they've helped and supported us. We've got the Sacopolis Library Galleria, which is a beautiful space. You know, we're going to be honoring some of the most powerful and impactful voices in our community, as well as, you know, honoring some folks that we lost this year. The Sacramento poetry community took a couple big losses, as far as like Angela James and Cleo Cartel, especially, like just loved ones and family members that we're missing a lot right now.
Yeah.
And that's a good event to get together and to memorialize, to remember, to celebrate.
Absolutely.
I'd love to get a little bit of a taste of what people can experience. I don't know if both of you have something that you can share. David?
Yeah. So for context, my father was born in Cuba. He was part of the Cuban Revolution. And as a kid, he would hand out like secret messages to people because he was a newspaper delivery kid. So this is about revolution. Revolution does not start in the streets. Revolution starts from within, spreads from others' lips to your ears to your mind to your lips as you learn to speak revolution, as your heart beats revolution, as you build and seek revolution in the youth. Tell them revolution does not start in the streets. Revolution is wisdom shared between you and me. Revolution is communities forming. Young bodies growing old into elders who speak of the days before revolution was born. It is not your marketing campaign. It is not your Facebook page. It is not your 20,000 views on that video you made. Revolution does not start on your screen. Revolution is you. Revolution is me. Revolution is we standing together to be better than we had been. Yeah, snaps work. You know, claps, cheers, all the deal.
All right, Andrew, we have about a minute left. I would love to get some of your style.
I got two short poems because I've been working on these real bite-sized pieces. The first one is, poetry is how we speak ourselves into existence. That's it. Snaps. The second one, I think, is the most sage advice I've ever given. Only consider the opinion of those who have washed your dishes.
Hey, I'm done with that. We give a lot of people a lot of power when they don't even really touch our lives, right?
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
You know? Wash dishes. Well, thank you both, Andrew and David. It's going to be a great time on Thursday. And is the event free?
The event is free, but unfortunately, it is sold out this year.
Awesome.
But yeah, the contest is still open. The curriculum is available. Everything is available at SacramentoPoetryDay.com. If you're on Instagram, you can find us on Sacramento Poetry Day.
Andrew Defy and David, and yes, Laurette DeMola. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It was a lot of fun.
Take care, everybody.
That's it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. If you want to join the conversation, email us at insight@capradio.org. Thank you to producer Sarit Lashinsky and managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital producer is Chris Hagen. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer is Chris Feltz. Our show music is produced by Adrian Gilmore. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. Have a great day. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We bring you in-depth, long-form interviews with actors, directors, musicians, authors, journalists, and more. Listen to our Peabody Award-winning Fresh Air podcast from WHYY and NPR.